So yeah, so Philip, yeah, if you want to. So good morning, everyone. On behalf of NSF Insights, I welcome you to our distinguished lecture series. Thank you all for joining. I know this is a busy time of the semester, so appreciate you taking the time to join. It is with great pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Barbara Lishkov, distinguished computer scientist and a great inspiration to so many of us. So, Barbara received her BSc in mathematics from University of California, Berkeley, and a PhD in computer science from Stanford University in 1968, one of the very first women, among the first women to receive a PhD in computer science. Subsequently, she worked at MITRE Corporation and then at MIT from 1972 onwards, where she is an institute professor and has held several leadership positions in the past. Her research interests are in distributed and parallel systems, programming methodologies, programming languages. She has a long list of accomplishments. It's difficult to go through all of them. So among a few among those, she's a member of the National Academy of Engineering, the National Academy of Sciences, the National Inventors Hall of Fame, and the Massachusetts Academy of Sciences. And very importantly, for the science community, she received the ACM Turing Award in 2009 and the IEEE One Woman Medal in 2004. So today she's going to talk to us about her reflections on programming methodologies. And so before I turn it over to her, I just want to let our audience know that if you have questions, just feel free to type them into the chat session, chat window as the webinar progresses. Once the presentation is completed, I will then go through those questions that have been posted in the chat window, and that will be our mode of interaction. So thank you once again for joining. And again, it's a great pleasure that I ask Dr. Barbara Lishkov to present her distinguished lecture.
Okay.
So please.
All right, thank you for that introduction. I was asked as part of my talk to talk a bit about my career. This talk actually has a lot built into it anyway, but I wanted to start if I can figure out how to get to the next slide, which I can't. Try this. Oh, here we go, sorry. Okay, so this repeats a bit of what you heard. I grew up in San Francisco. I went to Berkeley. In those days, I mean, Berkeley is a great school, and in those days, it was actually free to go to Berkeley. I started off in physics because I think I thought that was the hardest major, but I realized pretty quickly that my physical intuition is not that great, so I switched to math, and I finished up with a BA. It was not a Bachelor of Science in math in 1961. And I applied, I should say, by the way, that there were almost no women in my classes. I can remember one other woman in some of my math classes, but that was about it. This was not really the thing you were supposed to be doing if you were a woman at that period of time. I applied for graduate school. When I graduated, I got into a couple of places, but I decided that I really wasn't ready to make that kind of commitment. And so I decided instead to get a job. And so I moved to the Boston area. That was where my father's family had come from. And I went there with a friend of mine who graduated from Stanford. And when I arrived there, I looked for a job. And I couldn't find a good job as a mathematician, which really isn't surprising because you need a lot more math than what I knew to do something interesting. But I was offered a job as a programmer. I didn't even know computers existed at this point. And there were computers at Berkeley, but I was not in the engineering school and I really didn't know anything about them. And they were hiring people like me in those days because there was no computer science major, and therefore there wasn't a pool of trained people that they could rely on. And so they would hire people like me who didn't know anything, but they thought maybe we could do the work. And my first day on the job, they handed me a Fortran manual and a little program to do. And they said, you know, go forth and write this program. And so I was entirely self-taught in Fortran at that job. I discovered something that I really, really liked. I was really, really good at it. I worked at MITRE for a year, and then I switched to work at Harvard. And at Harvard, I was working on their machine translation project. So that was an early AI project where they naively believed that just in a few years, they would be able to be translating from English to some other language. Although at that point, their program couldn't even successfully parse sentences. None of this had anything to do with me because I was just a programmer. And my job was to maintain a very large program written in assembler. So think about, in those days, it was all printouts. Think about a printout about 2 inches thick. That was the size of that program. This was a great choice for me. I actually did it because I liked the commute better, but it turned out to be a great choice because now I got to learn how that machine worked. It was a 7094. And so I then could understand what the Fortran compiler had been doing and what was really going on when programs executed. Plus, I got to see a very big program that I had to maintain, and this taught me a lot about good programming practice. Early in that time at Harvard, I decided to apply to graduate school because I was learning very fast, but it was clear that I could learn a lot faster if I had somebody teaching me. And so I went to graduate school. I decided to go to Stanford because I wanted to go back to the Bay Area and started there in 1963. And I went there without any support. I didn't even really know there was such a thing. And my recollection is that walking up the steps on the very first day there, I met John McCarthy and asked for support. In retrospect, this seems highly unlikely that I would do that. But at any rate, I did end up working with McCarthy. He did support me with an RA. In retrospect, I suspect they thought I would be working in AI because of my work at Harvard, even though I wasn't a researcher in AI. So Stanford was great. I think there were 5 people admitted the year I arrived. It wasn't even a computer science department yet. I realized partway through, and by the way, I was the only woman that year. Sue Graham came the following year. I realized partway through that I really would prefer to be in computer systems, but I decided to stick with AI to get my PhD, and then I would be able to go on and make changes in what I was doing. When I graduated in 1968, I didn't have any offers of good faculty position, which I naturally thought made me think, well, I'm probably not good enough, which is what you think when something like that happens to you. But at any rate, I decided to go back to MITRE. Now I wanted to go back to the Boston area because the man whom I married was living there. And but I went to MITRE, and instead of being a programmer, I was now a researcher. And this turned out to be a great thing because at MITRE, MITRE works for the government, as I'm sure you know, and they were doing research in system programming systems, and they needed people to do this work. And so my first day on the job, I was handed this great project to, first of all, implement a machine architecture in microprogramming, and then I implemented a time-sharing system to run on top of that. And then in about 1970, when that project was finished, I was asked to look into the software crisis. So what is the software crisis? Many people today don't know what it was, but the problem was at that point in time, we simply did not know how to build programs that worked. And as a result, software development efforts failed. And it was very common in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s to pick up the newspaper and see a report about company X who had spent millions of dollars and hundreds of man years. And in the end, they just had to throw out the entire system because it didn't work. Part of the problem was that they didn't have well-trained people. Part of the problem was that they had a tendency to skimp on the hardware with this sort of naive idea that the software could make up the difference. There was very little understanding of what it meant to build software and how much work it was. But at any rate, this was clearly a crisis. The government was very concerned because they were building quite advanced software systems. And so I was asked to think about what could be done about that. I should say, by the way, the name of this talk is Reflections, because when I got the Turing Award in 2000, it was actually 2008, although for some reason, in 2010, although for some reason it's called 2009, I started reflecting on my career, and I went back and thought about all these early years in program methodology. So here I am in program methodology, and so of course I did what any intelligent person does, I start to read the literature. And I discovered that program methodology was about two main topics. One was about design, and the other was about program structure. And I'm going to tell you about just a few of the papers I read. Some places are running programs for their undergraduates where they have them read these old papers. There are many interesting old papers that students ought to know about. So here's the first one. I'm sure you all know this. Edsger Dijkstra wrote not a paper, but just a letter to the communications of the ACM, go-to statement considered harmful. And another thing you may not be aware of is that in those days, programming was held in it was not thought to be an interesting intellectual challenge. And programmers were kind of dismissed as doing interesting intellectual work. I actually saw this, in fact, even into the 80s, when I would visit other departments where the departments were controlled by mathematicians and they sort of dismissed the intellectual content of programming. Dijkstra was partly making a point that programming is a difficult intellectual problem. He's talking about the fact that in order to understand whether programs are working correctly, we need to reason about them. And what we have in front of us is a piece of text. But what's actually happening is you have a program running, so you have to go from this thing in front of your face to thinking about the thing that's happening under the covers. And the reason he thought the go-to statement was bad was because it disrupts the relationship between what you're looking on the text and what's happening in practice when the program is running. And the way I like to think about this is that you're debugging a program, you get to a place where there's an error. In order to understand how you got there, in understanding what's going on, you have to think about how you got there. And if you have well-structured programs with, you know, while statements, if statements, and procedure calls, it's relatively easy to do this. But if you have a program with go-tos in it, and these were sometimes referred to as bowls of spaghetti because it was like you had pointers everywhere, it can be very, very hard to figure it out. This paper was very controversial, partly because people thought that without go-tos, maybe they couldn't write the programs they needed to write, because programming languages were pretty primitive in those times compared to what we have today, and their control structures were somewhat lacking. But the other one was that Dijkstra tended to annoy people, and people were very annoyed because they said, I write very good programs and I use go-tos, and that is absolutely correct. You can write excellent programs in any lousy programming language, and you can write terrible programs in even a very good programming language. But nevertheless, Dijkstra was absolutely right. The go-to statement was not a good idea, and we were able to manage just fine without it. Okay, excuse me. The second paper is by Nicholas Viert. This is about design, top-down design, which was also a topic of interest at the time. And Nicholas had an idea that you sort of wrote an abstract program. This is like what we think of today as computational thinking. You know, you divide the program into tasks and you pick up one of those tasks and think about it some more. And his example was the eight queens problem. He said, let's think about this problem as adding the next queen to the next column. So you have a solution that works for n columns. You try to add the queen to the next one. If you can do it, you go forward. Otherwise, you backtrack and continue that way. That was his example. We know today that top-down design really is the way to go, because after all, if you don't think about the problem you're trying to solve, I don't see how you can possibly actually solve it. But of course, it's not a simple thing where you can just sort of march right down like that. The third paper and the last one is one by Dave Parnas. Parnas wrote a couple of papers about this, and now he's getting into this issue of modularity, which I think is really the key issue in programming methodology. And what he said in another paper was, there are these things called modules. We know we want our programs to be built out of them, but we don't know what they are. And that was the problem at the time. In this paper, he talked about the connections between modules. And the point he's making here is that when people thought about these modules, whatever they were, they neglected all sorts of connections. So for example, they might think about a procedure as a module. In fact, that was basically the only module mechanism they had. But they might neglect the fact that the procedure was communicating with the outside world via a whole bunch of global variables. And so he's saying you have to capture everything about what the module is doing in order to be able to make modularity work. Okay, so I read these papers. I read a whole bunch of others, and I realized that I had invented, I want to stop for a minute and just talk about modularity today. So here's what we know today. A program is a collection of modules. Each module has an interface described by specification. So here we're talking about Dave Parnas's thing. And we understand that that interface had better be the complete way you interact with the module, and the specification had better describe all the behavior. And an example of a module is a sort routine where the interface is the arguments and results, and the specification says when you return, the array is in sorted order. So it's a difference between what the module does and how it does it. There's nothing in that description about the fact that I'm using whatever sort routine I chose to use. And then we know now that we can talk about correctness. A module's implementation is correct if it meets its specification. And this gives us local reasoning, which is the powerful thing we're looking for, provided we can be certain that the rest of the code depends only on the specification and doesn't, in fact, somehow or other interact with the module in some other way. So actually in 1970, when I was working on this, we knew that we wanted modules. We didn't understand what they were. We understood the benefits, the local reasoning, and independent development was maybe the most important thing at that time because you had teams of programmers and you had to give them different things to work on. And we may not have understood the modifiability quite so well, but what that means is we understood that you might have to change a piece of the program, and if you had it developed correctly, then you could rip out that piece, replace it with another, and the system as a whole would continue to work. The problem was we had absolutely no idea what the modules were. Procedures were all that we understood. And these are nowhere near powerful enough to build systems. And people didn't get the connections right, as Parnas was saying. Okay, so I thought about all these papers and a bunch of others, and I realized that I had invented a design methodology, not a design methodology, that's what I called it, but more like a modularity idea. And this paper was actually about design also, but I'm gonna talk about the modularity. And this was when I was working on that time sharing system that I had developed in the previous project. Time sharing was a new idea at the time. And I was very concerned. I had a small group of programmers about how we were going to be able to produce this fairly complicated system in a way that was effective. And the way programs were built at the time, there was an awful lot of communication through global variables. So imagine that there's some huge global state, and then you have these modules, and whatever they are, and they're all interacting with one another through that global state. And this is really not a very good idea. So what I decided to do in the development of this Venus system was to break up the global state into what I called partitions. Each partition owned a part of the global state, and the rest of the program did not access that state. So that state was local to the partition. And in order to provide access, the partition provided operations, procedures that could be called by the rest of the program. and only those procedures accessed that state. So what you see here actually is a very modern way of looking at modularity, and it was new at the time. I wasn't inventing a methodology at the time. I was just trying to get that system to run. Okay, so now it's 1972 and I moved to MIT. So what happened was I wrote up a paper on Venus, the time-sharing system that I had developed in my previous project at MITRE. And by the way, I should stop for a minute and say, the fact that I went to MITRE was really a gift, because I was able to make that move from AI to systems without all the added pressure I would have had in a university job of teaching courses and so forth. So, you know, it's like a door closed and another door opened. And that actually has been my experience in my career. I mean, that's what happened to me when I didn't get a job in math, and therefore I got into computer science instead. And, you know, if I'd gone to university, I don't know what would have happened. But this way, I felt like I had a candy box at MITRE. I had these wonderful projects and I was just doing them and learning a ton of stuff. Anyway, I had written a paper on Venus in 1971, submitted it to SOSP, and which is, as you know, the top systems conference, and it was a prize paper at SOSP. And meanwhile, Title IX was about to pass. And Title IX, as you know, had to do mostly with athletics, access for women to athletics, but it was having an impact on access for women to things in universities in general. And so some universities, and MIT was one of them, I would say a handful in 1972, decided they were looking for women on the faculty. And sitting in the audience at my talk at SOSP was Corby, Fernando Corbeto, and Jerry Salzer was a professor at MIT. He was the head of my session. And they were looking, because Jerry Wiesner, who was the president of MIT, had told them he was interested. This kind of stuff does come from the top. And so I was invited to apply to MIT, and I went there in the fall of 1972. And here's a kind of a funny story. I can't remember his name. The Ethernet guy. I'll think of his name. Anyway, he tells a joke about how I got his job. He applied to MIT. They gave me the job instead. I mean, look how badly he ended up in the end. And sometime I'll think of his name later, but this is what happens as you get older. Okay, so I moved to MIT in 1972. And honestly, this was a perfect time for me to move, because at MITRE, the way it worked was we'd look for calls for proposals from the government. And so, you know, I would have worked on program methodology for a bit. It's not clear I would have continued working on it because something else would have come up. But at this point, I was really hooked. Program methodology was a very important topic, and I was just really interested in it. And what I was thinking about was this question about, we had all these really good papers, and they would describe a way of doing something, and they would give you an example, and you'd read that paper, and you'd think, boy, that really is the right way to do it. But then when you came to the program you were working on and you tried to apply those ideas, it just kind of fell apart. And I think maybe it fell apart partly because it just wasn't very well defined. It was a lot of hand waving. So I was thinking about, what can we do about this? And my way of working, by the way, is I work 9 to 5, more or less. Maybe it's, 9 to 6 or whatever, very intensely, and then I stop for the day. But that doesn't mean, and I developed this in my year at MITRE after my undergraduate program, when I discovered how effective you can be if you really use those hours, and how useful it is to not work, because this gives you a chance to rest, and then you come back to your work rested the next morning, plus your subconscious is still working, and I'm still thinking about stuff. And so every day, I might go home with some problem I've been considering, and overnight, maybe it got solved. In the morning, when I was thinking about what am I going to do today, I often discovered I had a solution to a problem I hadn't figured out how to solve yesterday. So anyway, at some point, somehow, I got the idea of abstract data types. And it seems kind of obvious in, seems kind of obvious in retrospect. I sort of saw that you could think of partitions as data abstractions. So here's the partition. It looks kind of like an object, but really it's not. Think about it as the program, the class that implements the data type. It provides you with a bunch of operations. The representation of the objects is hidden. And some of these operations are constructors and others are the operations that you use to interact with the objects. But nobody had made this connection yet. So I had this wonderful, you know, moment when all of a sudden I saw that I could make this connection. And I understood immediately that this was very important. And the reason it was very important is because it links modularity to design. Because the way you design is by inventing abstractions. In fact, when I was teaching my course in how to write big programs, I would talk about a methodology that said, invent an abstract machine with all the operations, i.e. the procedures and all the data types, i.e. the data abstractions that you would like to have. And then you can just implement your program using that abstract machine. And then you pick up one of those abstractions and continue going. But they're abstractions. They're not just pieces of code. They're abstractions. And that was really important. And furthermore, I didn't think programmers would have any trouble with data types because they already understood how to invent procedures. So they understood procedural abstractions. This is just another one. And starting to think about what kind of abstract data do I need? That wouldn't be an issue for them. They understood data types already. In fact, of course, there were data types, data abstractions in their higher level programming languages that were implemented by the compiler. And but in order for this to work, we're going to need something in programming languages. So I started to think about programming languages. And I started to work on this with Steve Zillis, who at that point was a graduate student at MIT. He was also an IBM employee, and he had had a similar idea. And so we decided to see what we could do with it. And what we're doing now is we're trying to think about what would it mean to have a programming language that supports abstract data types. And of course, we read the literature. We were pretty well positioned because I was very familiar with Lisp, since I had done my whole thesis in Lisp. And Steve came from IBM, and so he was up on all those IBM languages, which were the major languages at the time. And of course, we knew about other languages like the Algol family and so forth. Okay, so Steve and I read the literature, and I'm just going to mention a couple of things. This is an early paper on Simula 67, clearly a very important piece of work. We looked at this. We felt that its main point had to do with hierarchy. And we thought that was kind of not what we were interested in. Plus it had no encapsulation. So this idea that you limit access to internal state to just the module, that wasn't in there at all. So we didn't go in that direction. I'm not gonna tell you very many papers at that point. This one we found very interesting, Jim Morris, Protection in Programming Languages. And what Jim was doing there was he was defining rules for modularity. And what he said in that paper is that in order for modularity to work, the first rule is that code outside a module must not modify the data managed by the module. And that's clearly necessary because what you want for modularity is independent reasoning. You've got to have a barrier around the module if this is going to work. If some code on the outside can get in there and muck with your internal state, then your reasoning isn't going to work at all. So that was the first point Jim was making. He also pointed out that really the code on the outside shouldn't even look at your internal state. And this is important. It's really important for, there's two ways of thinking about it. If the internal state is observed, this means your specification ought to be covering it. But another way of looking at it is your specification's okay, you just better protect it because you want to be able to replace this module, this implementation with another one if for some reason you discover it's not good, like it isn't implemented fast enough. And if code on the outside could have observed your internals, you are much more limited in what you can do. Okay, so we read the, however, Jim then went on to say, well, how are we going to manage this? And he suggested something akin to encryption. You sort of encrypt all objects coming out of the module, and when they come back in, you can tell if they've been mucked with, and so therefore you're in control. But of course, this is obviously not a solution that's going to fly in practice. Okay, so Steve and I thought about this, and we worked on this for maybe only 6 or 8 months. Our mode of record of working was we met every day at lunchtime, or almost every day. And my recollection of the summer of 1973 was that it was sunny every day in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which obviously wasn't true, but we met outside in a lovely area. And then we would think independently. And by the end of that summer, we had written up our ideas and submitted it to a conference that I don't believe exists anymore, but was about programming language research at the time. And this program made a big splash because this was an idea whose time had come. And basically what it did was it was a sketch of what the programming language needed to do. And we were focused on the idea that we need a language and a compiler that's going to enforce the necessary rules at compile time. Okay, so now it's the fall of 1973, and I took the obvious next step of, I forgot to say something about MIT. I'm going to go back for a minute. I meant to tell you that when I arrived at MIT, so I did tell you that Title IX came along and that its impact was that universities were looking for women. And in fact, when I had applied for faculty positions in 1968, there weren't very many women in faculty positions at universities, and they really were not looking for women. And maybe this was particularly true in STEM, but I think it was true across the board. And when I got to MIT in 1972, there were 10 women on the faculty, of a faculty of almost 1,000 people. I was the first woman in computer science. Computer science wasn't a department. It was in the double E department. And later the double E department became electrical engineering and computer science, which it is still today. But at that point, it was just double E. And there was one other woman in my department, Millie Dresselhaus, a very distinguished physicist. I was the first one in computer science. And one of the things I noticed in the couple of years after I joined MIT was quite a number of women were added to the faculty who had previously been in research positions. So, I mean, this is what, you know, really competent women had been doing before things started to change. Okay, so now continuing on my way here, I was working on Clue. And I did this work primarily with 3 graduate students who showed up in my office, is the way I think about them, in the fall of 1973, wanting to work with me. It wasn't quite that way. I mean, Russ Atkinson, I talked to him later, and he said, well, what really happened was you were my academic advisor. That meant I advised him about what courses to take, and you suggested that I join your research group. So, you know, anyway, these 3 students were the main ones. It was quite a large research group, though. I mean, a lot of people came to our design meetings. We had weekly design meetings. In this picture, that's me in around 1974, and that's Jack Dennis, who was a professor at MIT, and he was one of the people that helped me. In fact, I wrote my first NSF proposal at that time, and I think Jack was a co-author, and he certainly helped me write the proposal. And Jack used to come to our weekly meetings. And of course, Steve was still involved, although Steve was now working on his PhD thesis, which was about algebraic specifications for data types. And then there were a number of other people who were, as time went by, more people joined my research groups, but others were interested and they would come to the weekly meetings. Okay, so, but the 3 graduate students I mentioned, they were the main designers. And it was clear that the next step had to be to design a programming language, but here's my rationale, and I had a well thought out rationale. The nice thing about a programming language is it's got rules. It has to be precise. It is a mathematical object, even though in those days it was described by a programming language manual, which often had mistakes in it, or ambiguities. And so the first compiler would resolve the ambiguities in one way and the second would do it differently. And so there was a mess because this was before we had formal specifications and so forth and so on. But nevertheless, compared to a paper in the literature that showed you an example and waved its hands, this is much more precise. And the other thing is programming language is a tool. And you have to understand with a tool whether it really works. So, you know, it's important that it be convenient to use. It's important, you know, sufficiently simple. It does the things it needs to do, it needs to have the right expressive power, and it has to have good performance. It doesn't have to have huge performance. Performance is sometimes overrated, but it has to be good enough that you don't mind using it. So by designing and implementing a programming language, we were figuring out what programming, what abstraction really was, data abstraction, and we were also making sure that it would work in practice. And although it seems obvious today, it was not obvious at the time that this was going to really work. And I'm not going to tell you much about Clue, but I just want to point out some facts about it so you have a sense of the world at that time. First of all, we were absolutely determined to do compile time type checking. And actually, if you look at this slide, mostly what you see is a kind of a love-hate relationship with Lisp. So I did my thesis, it was chess endgames in Lisp, and I was always so furious when I would have to discover an error in the program by debugging that could have been caught by a compiler if only we had compile time type checking. So I thought, really, it would be great to have something that enforces the rules. And furthermore, with this whole new idea of data abstraction, we needed to get our head around what it meant to make sure that it worked. Okay, so static type checking, heap-based, that's Lisp. And this may surprise you looking back today, but in those days, there was a lot of controversy about pointers. Pointers are evil. You shouldn't have them. Don't want a heap. Ridiculous. And Bill Wolf and Mary Shaw were working on AlphaArt at the same time. This was the other programming language research project that was investigating data abstraction. And they were using a non-heap-based approach. And actually it caused them a big problem because the thing about data abstraction is it has each, the data type has objects. You don't actually want to think about how they're implemented at the time that you're defining what the type means. And that means you don't actually know how big they are. And with a heap-based approach, no problem. You know, all you have in the stack is a pointer and you don't have to worry about how much space it takes on the heap. But if it's in the stack, this is a big pain in the neck and it caused them a lot of trouble. Separate compilation, this is Lisp too, because that was just the way you did it. You wrote one procedure at a time, you just kept going. And that was also very freeing. And then a bunch of stuff I didn't do because when you're engaged in a challenging research project, you throw out as much as you can. I decided no concurrency. Jack Dennis would have liked to have seen concurrency, but I decided that we had enough on our plate without worrying about that too. No go-tos because I thought Dijkstra was right. No inheritance because that seemed like a distraction. Okay, now just one more slide about Clue. It took us several years to design it and implement it because we had to innovate in many more ways than you might have expected. This again has to do with what programming languages were like at the time. First, we invented a mechanism for implementing data types. Those are the clusters, and that's where the name Clue comes from. But then we had to face up to polymorphism. So at that point in time, programming languages didn't have any notion that you could write a piece of code and it would work for many different types. And it kind of worked okay when you didn't have data abstraction because what your programming language had in it was just a very small set of types. And so maybe this wasn't a big deal. Although honestly, it must've been annoying if you had to rewrite your sort routine because it had to deal now with arrays of reals instead of arrays of integers. But anyway, as soon as you have data abstraction and you can see new types marching down the road, you know you're gonna have to write code that handles many types. And not only that, but you want your data abstractions themselves to be polymorphic. You want to have a set, you know, not a set of integers, not a set of reals. You want to be able to define the set once and then have it work for many different types. But it wasn't at all clear how to do this. And it took us quite a while to figure it out. And we came up with a mechanism that was mostly, but way ahead of its time, like what they have in Haskell now, the Haskell type classes. And then we needed to deal with iteration because many data types are collections. And when you have collections, you want to iterate over them without destroying them. And so we invented iterators, most like what are called generators, or rather they are called generators. I forget the modern terminology. It was a very nice mechanism. It was not a data abstraction. It was more like a procedure. And we had to deal with exception handling. At that point, people didn't know what exception handling should be like. There were various proposals. John Goodenough wrote a paper in 1974, I think, was talking about all the different things that were available. You know, there was a question about, do you have the resumption model versus the termination model? And we had to sort of wade through all of this. And we came out with a very nice mechanism. There were other issues that we had to worry about, like, you know, what is the normal case and how do you write your code and so forth. Anyway, we had to deal with all this stuff. So we had to innovate in many different ways. All right, so we finished Clue in the late 70s. I showed you the paper. Did I show you the paper? I think I did. if I didn't, I didn't, which came out, I think, around 1977. By then, we had the language defined. We might have still been working on various implementations. We used the usual trick of bootstrapping through a Lisp variant, and then after that, we wrote the compiler in Clue, and we had users, and so we had a you know, we were up in a going concern, and it was time to figure out a new research project. And I seriously thought about, well, first I thought about programming language research, but I decided that I didn't have any great ideas, so I didn't want to go on in that direction. I even thought about commercialization, but it was different in those days. I would have had to, you know, form a company. It would have had to spend all its time maintaining code that was being used elsewhere. It wasn't a research path. And so I was looking around and I read a paper by Bob Kahn about the ARPANET, which was still a fairly new thing in those days. And he talked about the dream of distributed programs or distributed computing, where you could have a program that had components running at many different machines. And wouldn't that be great? But nobody really knew how to do it. So I thought, oh, well, there's a great research project. And so I jumped into distributed computing. And what I have on the slide are some of the things I accomplished, but I'm not going to talk about those today. It's a fascinating field, distributed computing. But I continued to work on program methodology. Oops, let me go back. Just hang on just a minute. I'm going to go back a couple slides. But I didn't think about what I was doing as research. I was doing it mainly in the context of a course that I was developing at MIT. Since it's MIT, it doesn't have a name, it has a number, 6170. And it was our second course in computing. So the idea was the kids already knew how to write small programs, and now we were going to tell them how to write big programs. So it was really a program methodology course. And I taught them about modular program design. I taught them how to reason about correctness. I taught them about specifications. Much of this was done jointly with John Guttag. John had done his PhD thesis on abstract model specs. No, maybe he did, I forget, specifications for abstract data types. And you know, we had the students writing specifications. We had them implementing the abstraction function and the rep invariant. I mean, we were teaching them all this stuff. And so as I said, I continue to think about this. We taught them a top-down design methodology and so forth. And so the only thing I'm going to tell you about is one thing that came along in the programming methodology area, and that was the stuff about type hierarchy. So in 1987, I believe, I was asked to give the keynote at Uppsala. So Uppsala was a new conference then. And another thing about what was going on in research at that time, which seems kind of odd today, but was true then, is the East Coast and the West Coast were very far apart. And what was going on out there was different from what was going out in the East. So in the East Coast, we were working on data abstraction. On the West Coast, they were working on Smalltalk and Smalltalk varieties. So they were over in the inheritance area. And when I was invited to give this keynote at Uppsala, I thought, oh, well, this is a good opportunity for me to look into all that work that had been going on the West Coast. And so I started reading lots of papers on small talk and other object-oriented languages that were being designed based on the work that had been done on Smalltalk. And of course, Smalltalk is based on Simula 67. And so what I discovered when I read these papers was that, as you know, Smalltalk provided inheritance. And of course, it was a predecessor of the modern languages we use today, just like my work on Clue was a predecessor. And people were interested in inheritance, but it was used for two different purposes. It was used, first of all, as an implementation technique. So if I have an implementation of something, some data type, you know, like Windows, then I could have a subtype, I mean, a subclass that implements Red Windows by just sort of borrowing from the code and adding a little extra stuff. And I have never actually been all that interested in that stuff, though I don't deny that it seems to be useful for various things. One of the things that struck me, though, in reading the papers on these languages, these object-oriented languages, was the way people didn't talk about specifications at all. They would talk about the meaning of a subclass by explaining its differences in code from what was going on in the superclass. So that was kind of interesting and very different from what we were doing in 6170, where we were working on specifications. I also discovered, though, that they were interested in type hierarchy. And that, I thought, was really interesting. And it was clear from reading the papers that they hadn't any idea what it ought to mean, because I read a paper that talked about stacks and queues. And this paper said that each was a subtype of the other. And clearly what they were saying was that they had the same methods with the same arguments, and they weren't at all concerned about their behavior. But it's obvious that if you have a program that expects a stack and you give it a queue, it isn't going to work, because the data, the object that you pass to it, doesn't do what it expects. So I gave a keynote at Uppsala in which I gave a simple common sense definition of subtyping. I said, objects of subtype should behave like those of supertypes if used via supertype methods. And I mean, the behavior was the point I was making. Clearly you need the syntax to work out right, but the behavior is very important. And another thing that this sentence says is that you don't worry about the entire behavior, you only worry about what you can observe if you think you're observing a supertype. Okay, so I said that in an Uppsala paper, I mean, Uppsala keynote. I did subsequently write a paper about it, which I have a reference for a little bit later. This became a big deal. I wasn't paying much attention. And then one day in the early 90s, I think, I got an email from somebody saying, can you tell me if this is a correct interpretation of the Liskov substitution principle? So this name had appeared, and I all of a sudden saw that there was this huge chatter going on the internet about this principle. What did it mean? What's the exact definition, and so forth? And subsequently, in the 90s, Jeanette Wing, whom, as you know, used to be a director of SIZE, suggested to me that it really would be a good idea if we pinned down what it really meant, as opposed to just relying on this very loose common sense interpretation. And so what I have here is I have the original paper, which I don't think is a very good definition of what behavioral subtyping means, and then the paper with Jeanette, which really comes down to describing what it really is. Okay, so that's really what I wanted to talk to you about. I just wanted to tell you a funny story. When I got the Turing Award in 2009, it was not the year the award officially was for. Anyway, one of the things that was happening was my husband was on the internet every day looking at all the chatter. And as you know, the internet, as we unfortunately know today, is not necessarily a very nice place. And there were comments, and some were nice and some were not so nice. This one that I'm going to tell you about was not intended as a nice comment. the comment said basically, what did she get the award for? We already know this anyway. But honestly, this was a huge compliment because we didn't know this anyway. In fact, I discovered to my amazement when I got the award that many of my graduate students didn't know it. They did not realize that there was a time before data abstraction. They thought it was always there. So it's lovely to think that something I invented coupled with the work on Smalltalk and object-oriented language led us to what we know today. And that's really the end of my talk. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Barbara. Thank you for the great presentation, for your perspective and your reflection on abstraction and methodology, and taking us through this journey through time on how how modularity and abstraction sort of was incorporated into the languages and has become common practice today. So thank you once again for the great presentation. So now we have the floor open for Q&A. So if you have questions, please go through the Q&A tab and write down your questions there, and I will then read through them. So while we are waiting for those questions, of course, those who are panelists, Margaret and all, you could unmute yourself and ask your questions as well. So let me ask a question while others are putting their questions through. So could you sort of also maybe give your thoughts on how abstraction modularity is being incorporated in the undergraduate curriculum right now, and how the our current generation, the next generation of students are being trained in this, how it has evolved over, and what do you think your ideal vision would be for this?
So I can't talk too much about this because I officially retired in 2014, and I haven't been teaching since then. I've still been doing research with various colleagues. I certainly can tell you that when I give this talk to people in industry, I hear from them that their programmers don't know enough about modular design. And so they have a problem. The modules are not necessarily what they ought to be. People are violating the rules. Encapsulation is extremely important. If there isn't something that protects your modules from use from the outside, the whole thing falls apart. Modern programming languages, unfortunately, many of them do not protect this the way that they ought to do. And so they don't have that help. And it's always true in a big project that the weakest programmers are the ones that break the system. So it's unfortunate that we don't do a better job of enforcing encapsulation, because that would be a big help. But I also think it shows that the students are not being taught properly. And I don't know, I can tell you at MIT that the course that I developed, 6170, is still there. It's sort of morphed a few times, but we are still teaching our students about program methodology and modularity and so forth. But I haven't looked at those courses lately, so I don't know. And of course, the world is changing with AI. And it's very interesting. The world is changing in many ways. One thing that's been great is to see how program verification has come along. I used to think that it would never be possible to verify anything, except informally. And I always taught my students about informal arguments. But in some of the later work I did, like the work on Byzantine fault tolerance, would I like to have a formal verification of the core of that system, because if you can break the core of the system, the whole thing falls apart. And yet, important code is based on that. I don't think that our educational system is in such great shape, because somehow I think our students come out and they don't have a good enough understanding of modularity, encapsulation, and stuff like that. But I don't have a very broad knowledge of what happens at other universities anyway.
Thank you, Barb. So next question here from Ed Geringer is, how important do you think inheritance is now? Others may think that its importance has been overstated.
Well, I've never been a fan of inheritance, so I've never paid much attention to it. I think it has certainly muddied the water. In some ways, I mean, if you think about what happened in Java, their solution to inheritance was to try and use polymorphism. So when Java first came out, I mean, I was delighted to see it come out. It was the first mainstream language that really had data abstraction in it. And Andrew Myers was my student at the time. And we tried to get them to put polymorphism into the language then. And it didn't happen. And there was a mess, and they were trying to do it through inheritance, which really doesn't work. And even today, it's kind of a mess. And I don't know that anybody has gotten this whole thing straightened out. Andrew Myers is still interested in this question. And I don't go to programming language conferences nor pay much attention to what's going on at them. So let me put it this way. I really haven't changed my mind, but that doesn't mean, but I know Andrew thinks inheritance is important. So I don't know. The level I work at today is, one of the things I gave up was programming. You have a limited amount of time that you can spend on stuff. And so I have chosen to focus on design and higher level stuff, abstraction, the ideas that sort of put things together. I do tend to work right down to the system level where I think about how things really work. But the next step down of there's the code, you have to debug it and so forth, I stopped doing that. It is extremely time consuming. It's also, of course, lots of fun, but I stopped doing that. I don't know where we started with this, but anyway, I think what I'm saying is, I'm not out there in the trenches, and so it's a little hard for me to answer that question.
Sure. No. So next question is by Kirk Bradley. It's, which language today represents your best thoughts and wishes for software development?
Okay, so again, this is not something I'm paying attention to. So it's really hard. And I really have not been looking at modern programming languages. Mm-hmm. I am a little familiar with Python, but that's my knowledge there is several years old now. I was sorry to see that it didn't have encapsulation. I think the idea of, dynamic static type checking is a good idea. I think, or maybe just separating the idea of what you write and what you read. So this is something I often say early in the talk. At the time that I started working on program methodology, people were very focused on making it faster to write code. And in fact, there was even, what was the name of that language? The one where you could write the one-liners. So you could write these inscrutable little programs in a very few symbols. And this was considered a wonderful achievement. But the truth is that readability is much more important than writability. Code is written, then you have to read it. Other people have to read it. 5 years down the line, somebody who isn't even connected to you at all is trying to read it. So a way to sort of bridge that gap is to make it easier to write and have the support system fill in the details. So for example, people don't like to write down data types, but it's easy for the, for the runtime system to fill that kind of detail in. I think that's a great direction. I'm not following these conferences, so I don't really know what the current state of the art is, but I think that is a promising direction and is helpful. And as I said, of course, encapsulation. And yeah. And I guess one more thing. I've been doing a lot of work in concurrency recently. And of course, encapsulation is even more important there. If you don't if your module is not in charge of how the concurrency is working inside your highly concurrent data type, you know, all hope is over. I mean, it was already over without concurrency, but it's even worse now. And furthermore, you don't want a programming language deciding what that concurrency is, because as you know, at the time I did the work on Clue, all we knew about was locks. And then after a while, there was optimistic concurrency control. And now there's all this RCU stuff going on, you know, read, copy, update stuff, where you don't even, you know, you don't have any locks. And, you know, this stuff is all perfectly manageable if you just have an encapsulated module in which the complicated, you know, rules are being carried out. So it's encapsulation matters. Having a programming language that prescribes your concurrency control mechanism does not.
Thank you. So the next question is from Malgorzata Pinskia. She thanks you for the great talk, and the question she has, is the use of global variables as bad as the go-to statement?
I know, can you repeat that please? Because I didn't quite get it.
Is the use of global variables as bad as the go-to statement?
Yes, it is as bad. Now notice that, I mean, in fact, it's interesting to look back and think about ALGOL 60. Okay, so ALGOL 60, you know, it had this great innovation. It had these inner blocks, and the variables inside the inner block could not be accessed from the outer block. So that was good. But on the other hand, it was all set up so that you would communicate through the variables on the outer block. You don't want to do that at all. You really want, you have your modules, they're independent. But notice that there is a kind of global variable in all of our programs, and that is the file system, you know, the database. They're global. The global variables are still with us. I think they're used in a much more disciplined fashion now than they once were, but we did not get rid of them, and I don't think you can.
So Philip Shalom asked, so this is a question which you touched upon briefly earlier to the question I asked. It says, how do you approach teaching of programming modularity? What kind of examples or tool would you use? Could you give us some ideas?
Well, I can tell you what I used to do. It actually probably the person who might have the best ideas. So I have a couple of colleagues who are basically teaching the kinds of stuff that was developed in 6170. So John Guttag has an introductory course, and Srini Devadas also, and they use examples. And I don't know what those examples are, but they're very different from what I used to use. I used to use QuickIndex as an example. And it was, you know, a sequential program. But, and I think it was kind of boring for the students, you know, so you would use an example. I mean, first of all, I taught them about the methodology, the one I mentioned earlier about inventing abstractions and imagining you had an abstract machine. And then I would illustrate it by doing a design, starting from a problem statement and going through. Now, of course, what I've been doing in the last 30 years, 40 years, mm-hmm. is thinking about systems which are not sequential systems. And so, you know, there you're thinking more in terms of major, you start with your major subsystems. And I might work more from that level today if I was teaching that course. I would think about, it's an interesting question. You know, you have to walk before you can run. And I tend to think in terms of distributed systems and highly concurrent systems. I think it's a great question. John has a book, and I bet you he's got some interesting examples in that book that he uses for teaching. So that might be a good place to look. Mm-hmm. Yeah, QuickIndex is a very dated example, but of course I haven't actually taught that course since the 90s, so it's been a while.
Mm-hmm. Next question is from Wenwen Wang from University of Georgia. So thanks you for the wonderful, insightful talk and two questions. So the first one is, do you think abstractions also remove some potential optimization opportunities that can be exploited by compilers?
Abstraction is absolutely not in the way of what the compiler can do. In fact, a very powerful technique, well, remember inline substitution. So, you know, that's a simple optimization technique where the compiler exposes to itself the code of the procedure and then does all sorts of manipulations of the code so that you avoid the cost of the calls and so forth and so on, and you can get rid of variables and all sorts of stuff. And then if you change your idea and you re-implement the procedure, no problem, you just recompile, big deal. So in fact, I think it's quite the opposite. You know, abstraction is something that you think about, but you don't actually reason in terms of the code that runs on the machine. Although, of course, if the compiler is doing stupid things, you may run into a little problem, you know, like all those problems in the C++ compiler where it gets a little bit overambitious about what it's doing with your code. So the compiler had better be doing its job properly. But really, the idea that you work at an abstract level and then the compiler comes in and does all this manipulation, that's a great use of abstraction.
Yeah, I agree there, yeah. So the second question is a bit more general. It says, given the recent advances in machine learning, do you think computers will eventually be able to program themselves?
Yeah, isn't that an interesting question?
Interesting.
Yeah, let me put it this way. Well, first of all, you know, there's a lot of issues with what's going on in our world today, and quite a few of them are due to machine learning. So I think we should be putting our energy into trying to, you know, do whatever technologically we can do about fake news and, I mean, just think of the problems we have to face. Machine learning gives you 95% correctness. I mean, today it doesn't give you 100%. Programming is very precise. So I don't think we're ready for prime time here, although I know I have colleagues who think this is cute and you know, somehow you get an almost correct solution. I mean, I suppose if you're in an application where almost correct is good enough, it might work. But that seems like the big deal to me, the fact that we don't quite get all the way there and we want to get all the way there so that the code really works. And that's a big problem. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the issue about what's going to happen to software, what's going to happen to programmers, you know, our world is changing due to computer science. And who knows where we're going.
So next I have a show from Terry Langendion. So this is not a question actually, but would be interested in your thought about this. He says the modularity was developed about the same time in linguistics in the 1970s for the design of grammatical systems. And Jerry Fodor famously promoted the idea for the design of mind in the modularity of mind in 1975. My impression is that these ideas were not pursued with the same rigor as they were in computer science. So, I see that, you know, there was a lot of overlap in terms of languages design and all between linguistics and computer science. So.
Yeah, I that's way beyond my level of expertise. It was just striking me, you know, when we speak, we can be ambiguous. When we speak to a computer, we can't be ambiguous. I'm not sure that there is that much of a connection here, but I don't know. It's way out of my area.
Just going through the questions, there's another one on how we teach our students to design more. So how do we teach our students to design more effectively? So I know you've already talked about it. I don't know if you have.
Well, I had the students work in teams. So I started them off working on very small projects where they still had to design, but it was small enough that they could do it as a single person. And then later in the course, I had them work on teams on a larger project where they really had to subdivide and come up with a system that worked. And that was, I would say, only partly successful. And the problems were not, well, first of all, I should say, I actually don't believe you can teach design. So I believe maybe you can teach small scale, you can teach the principles of design, but not everybody has the ability to design. It's a skill. It's almost artistic, you know, because a design, if a good design has kind of elegance to it. So all I could teach was the principle of design. I could try to get across, you know, that modularity worked. So if you came up with a good design, it would be better than if you didn't come up with a good design. The problem with that team project also always had to do with people. It didn't have to do with, you know, and maybe these problems exist in industry too, but teams didn't always work. And it was very hard to monitor this and to help out the students. You know, you could have teams where there'd be one really strong programmer and they would just take over everything and nobody got to do very much. Or you could have, there were lots of issues with the women. You know, they had teams where there was a woman on the team and she was sort of sidelined. And so there were lots and lots of issues with running teams. But since large projects and modularity have to do with teams, in some sense, you have to go there because it's not until you get something big, you know, a small program you write yourself, well, you probably maybe won't notice that it was a problem. So,
yeah, I think, yeah, modularity maps nicely, or teams map nicely into modularity and they go hand in hand. So Thiaganandakupalan also has a question. What are your perspective on how to address the security gaps that software code seem to have overall?
Yeah. Are you thinking about the recent hacking into the government computers? Yeah, you know, this is hard. Mm-hmm. You know, my friends who work in this area, you know, they think about it as a game. You know, you up the security of your system, but the hackers are very motivated to break it. It would be, if we use better programming languages, that might help. You know, the vulnerabilities are often due to problems in the software that could have been avoided if we'd had a better programming language to begin with. It would be good maybe if we didn't have so much legacy code. But of course, the real problems are human interface problems. You know, how do we get people to not click on a link that they should not click on? So in answer to your question, you can see I don't have any solutions.
Yeah, and it also goes back into how do you teach them to write more effectively, and
I think what I'm saying is, even if you had a perfect system, if there were any way that clicking on a bad link is going to be a problem, and you know, I mean, you can't help but that being a problem, right. You know, so people who have worked on user interfaces and trying to figure out ways to design better interfaces, And nobody has a good solution. You know, people don't like to use passwords that are complicated, CAPTCHAs. For a while, they'll be useless because machine learning will be able to solve them anyway. And they're annoying. I think, you know, we should get our act together in the systems and build software that actually works. But there's, even if we did that, there's a whole other area of problems having to do with user interfaces. And so it's a very hard problem.
So the question is from John Zhang. He asks, what would be the most disruptive phenomena in programming or computation in general since 2004? Your retirement, in your opinion?
Oh, well, what's going on with machine language, clearly. I mean, machine learning, absolutely. So when I was at Stanford, I actually was interested in machine learning. But machine learning in those days was you write a program that thinks like a person. And that really wasn't very effective. And one of the reasons I left AI was because I thought this is never going to work, or it's too hard for me, or something like that. But you know, things are totally different now. And what you can do with machine learning is quite amazing. So, I mean, things have really changed. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm.
So I see no more questions. So I have one question. So I know that you talked about, you know, in terms of looking at program with go-to statements and all the abstractions made it difficult. So during the 70s, 80s, the hardware itself was sequential, and it was easy to sort of see how the program execute and debug. So I'm just curious about your thoughts on how the advances in hardware have impacted the reasoning about them, or even how you write and all the abstractions that you may have.
Are you asking me about how computers run today versus how they used to run?
No, or how the advances in the hardware, the multiprocessing systems that we have and all, impacted abstractions?
I don't think they've impacted abstractions, or at least that's not been my experience. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in the last 5 or 6 years working on multi-core computers. So I'm talking about highly concurrent programs. Abstractions are our salvation there. And, you know, what I said earlier about modularity and encapsulation being the thing that really matters. Now, I don't have experience with a lot of the other stuff that's been going on. So I really can't say anything about that. But I can tell you that as far as distributed computing is concerned, as far as highly concurrent programs are concerned, abstraction, if anything, is more important than it is in a sequential, simple sequential world that I was working in when I first started working in this area.
Okay, so I see no more questions. So again, thank you, Barbara, once again for the great presentation. Really, we thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm sure all of our audience has also enjoyed the presentation. So thank you once again. So I just also want to remind everyone that at 4 o'clock today, at least for all of the NSFers on the Zoom call, that we have going to have office hours with Barbara. So please do join us at 4 o'clock today. So thank you once again.
Thank you. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.